Welcome to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting to you from the coast of California. Today I'll be speaking about Cushing's disease, continuing the podcast series on the evaluation and management of patients with residual and recurrent Cushing's disease. While these podcasts would be useful separately, I would encourage you to go listen to the first episode of the podcast in this series. All right, let's get started. Once a diagnosis of residual or recurrent disease has been confirmed, the physician and the patient and other family members and healthcare providers must get together and decide on the most appropriate management for the particular patient. Now, those of you who know me recognize that I'm a firm believer in the individualization of a management plan for patients. No two patients are alike, and everyone has a different disease state and different hopes, goals, desires, and other mitigating factors that do affect not only the treatment plan chosen, but also the outcomes of treatment. So I think it's critical to recognize that though I'm going to talk about this in a sequential way, that does not imply that I proceed in this sequential fashion in the management of patients. In fact, usually patients receive one or more combination therapies once they have been diagnosed with residual or recurrent Cushing's disease. I will say, however, that one of the first considerations is whether the patient is a candidate for repeat surgery. Most of the series that have evaluated this will show that about 50% of patients who have residual recurrent Cushing's disease will enter remission with a second operation. So I believe that if there's tumor that's seen on MRI, that it's a viable option to consider repeat surgery. The most important thing in my mind, however, is that you see the very best surgeon possible. If your first surgeon was an excellent surgeon, you might even want to get a second opinion from another excellent surgeon. But if your first surgeon was a regular neurosurgical practitioner who doesn't focus on pituitary disorders and you have residual recurrent Cushing's, you probably need to go to a pituitary center and see one of the best surgeons to increase the likelihood that you're going to be rendered disease-free. And the good news is, even if you're not able to be cured with a second operation, if you have substantial tumor and significant hypercortisolism, repeat surgery may lower ACTH and cortisol levels sufficiently so that you will benefit clinically from a second operation. Furthermore, a tumor debulking may actually lead to additional treatment decisions that will differ depending on how much residual tumor you have, such as whether or not you're candidate for gamma knife radiosurgery or whether you must undergo conventional radiotherapy. I say gamma knife, but what I really should say is stereotactic radiosurgery, because there are other forms of stereotactic radiosurgery that aren't with the gamma knife. I do believe, however, that the gamma knife is probably the best approach to delivering stereotactic radiosurgery. The other major form is conventional radiotherapy. These two differ in that gamma knife radiosurgery is very more precise, whereas conventional radiotherapy is not as precise. If you will, apologize for using a gun analogy, but think of a rifle bullet as the gamma knife and a shotgun as the conventional radiotherapy, and those would represent the sprays of the radiation, so that we get a very tight hit on the target with gamma knife, but we get sort of a spray around the target with conventional radiotherapy. We might use conventional radiotherapy in patients who have larger tumors or those who have widespread disease or invasive disease or multiple foci of a tumor or a large tumor bed that needs to be treated. And gamma knife might be used in a patient with a smaller tumor, very localized disease, even if it's invasive, but sort of like a one small target, and certainly tumor that's away from the visual pathways. If a tumor is close to the visual pathways, we do favor conventional radiotherapy. The main difference to the patient for these two types of radiotherapy is that the gamma knife is usually one to two, sometimes three treatments, usually one treatment, whereas conventional radiotherapy would be 5 days a week for about 5 weeks. So although this is radiation, it's basically apples and oranges that we're throwing at the tumor, and you can't compare apples to oranges when it comes to cure rates or when it comes to side effects. What we do know with Cushing's and radiotherapy is that conventional radiotherapy will render into remission about 50% of patients. One study that came out of Spain suggests as high as 85%. But I think that most people would say that about 50% of adults and 50% of children would enter remission after conventional radiotherapy. The rate after gamma knife radiosurgery is about 50 to 75%. It may be a little bit higher because, again, these patients have smaller tumors and more limited disease than those who are candidates for conventional radiotherapy. Interestingly, with conventional radiotherapy, the time to remission is usually 5 to 7 years. And with gamma knife radiotherapy, it's about 18 to 36 months, with obviously some patients with either form of radiotherapy entering remission as soon as 6 months after treatment, and others, of course, obviously taking a little bit longer to get to a remission stage. The rates of hypopituitarism are probably about the same with these two forms of radiotherapy. It was thought that gamma knife radiosurgery would lead to less hypopituitarism than does conventional, but in my opinion, that doesn't necessarily play out in studies that others have done, nor in my clinical experience. So we do expect that patients may develop deficiencies of one or more anterior pituitary hormones in a 5 to 10 year period after radiosurgery. So it requires annual follow-up for the primary disease state and also for other pituitary functions after you receive radiotherapy in the setting of Cushing's. Now, obviously, if it's going to take years for radiotherapy work, we have to do something else for the Cushing's, and that's where medical management comes into play. We'll talk about that momentarily. But before I focus on that, I want to talk a little bit about bilateral adrenalectomy. Bilateral adrenalectomy is a treatment for hypercortisolism. It's not a treatment for the pituitary tumor. In this setting, we remove both the adrenal glands surgically. It used to be done through an incision across the flanks, but now it can be done endoscopically. The classic teaching about bilateral adrenalectomy has been to use it as a last resort when everything else has failed and you desperately need to get control of the hypercortisolism. Unfortunately, however, in that setting, patients are already very sick and their complication rates of surgery are extremely high. Complications including bleeding in the abdomen, infection, poor wound healing, and even death due to lots of different things, including pulmonary embolism. So some advocate that if you're not going to gain control of the pituitary tumor in a relatively short period of time, and especially if medical therapies have failed, that you proceed with adrenalectomy sooner rather than later so that you can diminish the overall mortality. The problem is that you're creating a new disease. You're creating adrenal insufficiency where patients have to take hydrocortisone and mineralocorticoid for the rest of their life. I will maintain that doing that is probably a safer long-term bet than having uncontrolled Cushing's with hypercortisolism. However, it's known that I think the statistics were that a patient would have two admissions every 3 years or so for adrenal crisis after having had adrenalectomy for Cushing's. So that's an expected consequence of this surgical treatment that patients need to know very well about. Obviously, patients have to take their mineralocorticoid and then adjust the dose of their glucocorticoid for stressful illnesses, etc. So it's not to be taken lightly. The timing needs to be considered in conjunction with the skill and expertise of the surgeons, treatments available at the institution, the patient's desires and wishes, the family, patient self-care, family self-care, the insurance that the patient will take, medications, and be able to adjust those medications with stress, etc. So it's a difficult decision to come to and has to be taken seriously, but there is some belief that perhaps endoscopic bilateral adrenalectomy should be performed sooner rather than later in the course of patients with residual or recurrent disease when you can't get control of the disease with standard approaches to treatment. Now, as an introduction to the concept of medical therapy, let me say that there are lots of different indications for medical therapy for hypercortisolism, whether it be Cushing's disease or Cushing's syndrome, and regardless of the cause. And I'll kind of go through the ones that stick out in my mind as the reasons that I might be considering medical therapy for patients. The first is in patients who are too sick to operate, where we want to use medical therapy to gain control so that their operative risk is diminished by having had improvement in their health and maybe restoration of normal blood pressure, glucose dynamics, better tissue healing, less coagulability, etc. The next would be in preparation for surgery in a patient who's sick, and they would do better if we got them under control for about 3 to 6 months prior, or while waiting for surgery if there's a delay on the part of the physician or the patient for one reason or another. Another time you might proceed with medical therapy is after primary surgery, when you've diagnosed the fact that the patient has residual or recurrent disease and you're waiting for the decision-making process, whether it be additional therapy or radiotherapy. And certainly while we're waiting the long time for radiotherapy to work, that's a classic example of when we might use medical therapy in a patient with residual or recurrent Cushing's disease. And finally, unfortunately, a number of patients with residual or recurrent Cushing's disease have negative MRIs because their tumors are microscopic and we don't know where it is. We can't get it out surgically. We don't know where to irradiate. So we use medical therapy when there are really no other treatments planned, and then we wait and watch and see with repeat MRIs whether a tumor rears its ugly head so we can nail it at some future point in time. So that would be probably the other reason that I use medical therapy, and probably the most common one is to sort of watch and wait and see until we get a tumor that we can go after. Now, I like to think of the medications available for residual and recurrent disease in different classes, if you will. The first class is those drugs that affect the tumor directly, and the drugs in that group are bromocriptine, cabergoline, cypraheptadine, and pasreotide, or Signifor. Next would be the drugs that are adrenal biosynthesis inhibitors, and the ones available now, largely ketoconazole. In the past, aminoglutethamide, and still sometimes with an investigational drug number, metirapone, and then there's a new drug that's under study that I won't discuss during this podcast. And then drugs that produce a medical adrenalectomy, if you will, and that would be mitotane. And then lastly, the glucocorticoid receptor blocker, mifepristone or Korlym. So let's go through these briefly based on the sites of action. So first, those drugs that act against the pituitary tumor. Bromocriptine and cabergoline are dopamine agonist drugs, and there are studies that show that a rare Cushing's patient will have a response and lower ACTH and then cortisol levels in response to treatment with these drugs. I've had a lot of experience early in my career using these drugs and actually presented at the Endocrine Society a paper using bromocriptine and cypraheptadine. But generally, while you can get control with these drugs, it seems to be temporary, so that there seems to be an escape. And after many years of going through these drugs in my patients, I have simply abandoned the approach of using bromocriptine and cabergoline in patients with Cushing's. It's just a low yield, so to speak. There are a few patients who will respond, and I know that some of you out there listening probably are on one of these drugs, and that's superb that it works. We'd like to hear your experiences if you'd care to share them. And then cypraheptadine is an anti-serotonin drug that was used years ago. Again, it can control some patients with Cushing's, but the responses are short-lived, and I don't bother with that any longer, largely due to the side effects, and the patients became very somnolent on treatment. The other drug in this class, the new one, is pasreotide or Signifor, and I'm going to devote a separate podcast to that drug, so I won't discuss it any further today. So in regards to inhibitors of cortisol biosynthesis, the principal drug that's available to us now is ketoconazole, and this is an antifungal drug that was shown in studies when used to treat HIV patients with fungal infections to cause adrenal insufficiency, so it was then applied to the use in patients with Cushing's. And we know through lots of studies that about 65 to 70% of patients with Cushing's can normalize their urine cortisol on ketoconazole. Usually I start at 200 milligrams twice a day, and you can increase the dose to 400 milligrams four times a day or 1600 milligrams daily as needed. The control is good. It's sustained. It's long lasting. And the biggest problem with this drug is about 15 to 30% of patients will develop abnormal liver function tests. And in fact, this, even though it's a reversible hepatotoxicity, this has led to the FDA after probably, over 20 years of use to, within the past few years, put a black box warning on this drug for Cushing's because of the hepatotoxicity. Not exactly sure what the black box warning says, but it's got a black box warning. There was a lot of concern that the drug might come off the market. But at the moment, we still have this drug available for our use in our armamentarium against Cushing's. Mitiaprone is an old standby drug that I think requires an investigational drug application to the FDA to be able to use it. Some of you out there are probably taking it. It used to be one of my favorite treatments, especially in combination with aminoglutethamide. Aminoglutethamide was a breast cancer drug that also blocked adrenal steroid synthesis, and the combination of the two was profound, and I could normalize almost anybody with a combination of those two drugs, or ketoconazole, or sometimes all three. So I was really happy with the management that we had available to us in the 1990s, but now we just have ketoconazole on the market in this particular class of drugs, and that might not be something we have forever because of that black box warning and the hepatotoxicity. So that leads us then to another drug that's available in this class. Well, hopefully one day will be available. It's under research right now, and it's an adrenal biosynthesis inhibitor, and we're trying to get some more information about that. Might be available at some point in the future, so stay tuned. And the next class, that of creating a medical adrenalectomy with mitotane, this is a drug that can generally, in most patients with Cushing's, control the hypercortisolism. The problem is the side effects are horrendous. It's a very toxic drug. And over my career, I've even had trouble with adrenal cancer patients wanting to take the medication regularly because of the side effects. What we do know, though, is that this is one of those drugs where you ramp the dose up over a few weeks, and then ultimately as the drug gets stored in the fat and the plasma levels start to rise after you've sort of stored up your fat stores, so to speak, you can get toxic levels. So you ramp the dose up, and then ultimately you start to lower the dose when the patient gets side effects. It's a drug that does cause toxicity to the adrenal cells, so it's like having an adrenalectomy with medication. But in my view, it's so difficult to use it because of the toxicity that I don't even approach it in the patients with Cushing's disease. Given the difficulties I've had with adrenal cancer patients taking the medication. And that brings us to the last drug, mifepristone or Korlym, which is a glucocorticoid receptor blocker. There's a lot of new information about this drug to control the symptoms and signs of Cushing's, and I want to devote a separate podcast to this particular drug. So that'll be coming up very soon. So that's it for today. I hope this has been useful bits of information for you. This is Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.